Thanks so much, Jack, and what an incredible series of talks to follow. I wanted to talk this evening about Ravenous of the National Food Strategy. The food strategy was a piece of work I did for government, and I knew that when I went about it, I wanted to do two things. One was to tell a story, and the other was to recommend specific policies. And when you're trying to change policy, in many ways, the story is more important because policy happens in fits and starts. It can be quite random, the events that bring about a particular change of position, whereas what underlies everything is the story. And the story that we decided to tell, oh, by the way, the book came because as soon as we'd published the National Food Strategy, my wife said, no one sane is going to go online and read an online government document. We had to turn it into a book. So that's what we did. And Jemima Lewis is her name. She wrote it with me. The story that we tell starts in 1914, sorry, 1945. It starts after the Second World War. There were 2.8 billion people on the planet. If you, scientists looking forward at that point, could see that with improvements in medication and sanitation, that the population was predicted to increase by up to 8 billion over the next 50 years. And what these scientists realized was that there wasn't going to be enough food to feed that many people. Up until that point in human history, when humankind had expanded, we'd simply dug up more land to feed ourselves, to plant more crops. This chart here shows from 1800 up till just that point in the war, three lines. The green line is the amount of land that was farmed. The grey line is the human population. The red line is the number of calories. And you can see them gradually rising pretty much together. If you went right back to the beginning of the Holocene, the period of stable climate that started in about 10,000 BC and continues to this day, you would see a similar picture. But if you look at the newspapers of the late 40s and early 50s, you see this repetition, this story of the Malthusian collapse, the fact that the population of mankind would be restricted by calorie shortage, there'd be starvation and wars of resource scarcity. What these scientists had not reckoned on was an extraordinary man, a man called Norman Borlaug, who was an American botanist. He'd grown up in Idaho during the Great Depression. He had seen hunger close up. He had seen food riots. He'd seen people starving on the streets of Idaho. And he set himself a life of trying to make sure people were fed well. And he ended up in Mexico towards the end of the Second World War, where he was sent by the Rockefeller Foundation to try and improve the farming there. And when he arrived, he wrote to his wife that the things that he had seen, and I quote, had clubbed his mind. He said that the condition of the soil and the lives of the people were terrible. They were barely scraping a living. He said, we have to do something. I don't know what to do, but we have to do something. And what he set about doing was quite simple in many ways. It was creating a new form of wheat. He had this idea that there were quite high-yielding forms of wheat at the time, but they had long stems. And when the wind blew, the stems would collapse. It was called lodging, and the wheat would be the yield would be lost. But he thought if I could cross that long-stemmed, high-yielding wheat onto a shorter-stemmed wheat, and maybe also wheat that was resistant to wheat rust, which was the worst disease that that wheat could catch in those days, and actually still is, I could create a wheat that could feed these people better. And he scuttled. He set up two research stations, one down by the sea, one up in the mountains, and that thus enabling him to have two seasons a year. And he crossed thousands and thousands and thousands of wheat strains by hand, literally cutting off the florets, tapping the pollen onto other forms of wheat, tying tiny little paper hoods onto them to keep the pollen on the wheats he was crossing. The Mexicans thought he was crazy doing this. He slept on the floor of his research hut. But by stubbornness as well as inspiration, he succeeded. And by the time he left Mexico in 1960, Mexico was self-sufficient in wheat. It was actually exporting some. It had been in importing about half of its wheat before that. And this success story was repeated for rice and for maize across the world. And this created what is known as the Green Revolution. And if you look at what happened after that, you see that the land, we actually farm slightly less land than we did back in 1945 because collectivization, collective farms in Russia, when the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of that went out of production. People have grown. There are now 8 billion people on the planet, and we grow about enough food to feed twice as many calories to 8 billion people from the same amount of land as we did to 2.8 billion people back in 1945. It's a miracle. It's an astonishing transformation. But almost nobody knows about Borlaug. We say in the book that if there'd been a biopic made of him, he probably would have been played by Jimmy Stewart because he was handsome, he had a good square jaw, American teeth. But there wasn't a biopic made of him because, as our first speaker said, you don't get famous for stopping disasters. But what Borlaug wasn't to know was that the system that he created, solving the problem, as is so often the case, caused other huge problems. And the first problem that he caused was that the food system is by far the biggest cause of environmental stress globally. And one way to think about that is just to look at the number of animals on the planet. This is 10,000 BC, this chart. These circles represent the total weight of animals on the planet. Back in 10,000 BC, there were about 2.5 million people, that tiny blue circle, dwarfed by the number of wild animals. If you fast forward today, you see a very different picture, which is to the same scale. The wild animals have decreased hugely. And that was initially due to our enthusiastic hunting and megafauna, but even more recently, since 1970, for example, the farmland birds in England have halved, whereas wheat yields have doubled roughly over that time. Horses, cats, and dogs now weigh almost as much as all of the wild animals. And the animals that we breed to eat weigh at any one time twice as much as all of the people and 20 times as much as all of the wild animals. The food system is by far the biggest cause of biodiversity collapse, by far the biggest cause of freshwater stress and pollution, the biggest cause of deforestation, of soil degradation, of the collapse of aquatic life. And after energy systems, it's the second biggest cause of climate change. It produces about 20 to 30% of our greenhouse gases every year, which leads to another quite frightening chart that was produced by the UN, by NASA, two different versions of it, which shows what yields might look like across the world of crops in a 2.5 degree climate change scenario. And what you see here is that actually wheat in the Northern Hemisphere, the yields of wheat are projected to increase. Wheat likes carbon dioxide, it likes warm weather, it likes water. Although this year, this is only a projection, this year there's a lot of wheat that hasn't gone into the ground. But in the Southern Hemisphere and the equatorial zones, rice and maize yields are expected to shrink. And this goes back to a kind of a situation that was imagined in 1945. You look at this and you think this looks like scarcity, starvation, mass migration, and even wars of resource. And it's not just the environment that this is hurting. It is our health. So this food system that produces so much plenty is now the biggest cause also of avoidable ill health. But in this country, by 2035, it's probably going to cost the type 2 diabetes will cost the NHS more than treating all cancers does today. It's also the biggest cause of the 2.8 million people who are out of work permanently of their disabilities. And so you kind of, if this plays forward, we become not only a sick but an impoverished country. And it's at this point in the book that people occasionally text me and go, "Oh God, Henry, this is really depressing." But actually, there is hope, and there is hope because we have changed the system in the past, and we are able, therefore, we should have hope that we can change the system in the future. And the way that we need to change the system is to understand what the feedback loops are that are going wrong. And luckily, there are two, and they are very obvious. And the first is depicted in this picture, two huge global conglomerates fighting it out for our children's breakfast bellies at eye level in the supermarkets. And the reason now that 85% of the food produced by fast-moving consumer good companies is deemed too unhealthy to tell to children is because it's simply you make more money selling that stuff because we have an appetite that is ancient and evolved to reward us with huge pleasure eating things that are high in fat and salt and sugar. And when those are calorie dense, lowered in soluble fiber, they fill us up less quickly. That is the evolved mechanism. The food companies have spotted that. They make more and more of that stuff. We eat more. They make more. We eat more. They make more and we get sick. And, you know, we now spend every year about £3.9 billion on confectionery alone, and only about £2.2 billion on fresh fruit and veg. This junk food cycle is completely dominating the system. The other thing that is going wrong is what we call the invisibility of nature. The fact that we not only is nature not visible in any of the success systems that we use, or measurements of success that we use to measure human ingenuity. It's not in your wallet. It's not in the balance sheet of companies. It's not in the way we measure GDP. We don't even try and measure it. So that we're actually, in fact, governments subsidize the destruction of nature with subsidies to industrial agriculture, to fishing, to energy. We're paying people to destroy nature. So we shouldn't be surprised that we're destroying it at such a rate. So just to end, where are we and can we fix this? I'm actually, notwithstanding everything I've said, quite optimistic. This was a picture taking. I was in Brussels the other day at a regenerative farming conference, and the farmers were in good spirits just up the road, dumping manure and burning tires. And you might think that actually the farming transition wasn't going very well, that we weren't going to be able to create a more regenerative farming system. But actually, if you look at what's going on, governments are trying to make nature visible and they are changing the incentives in the system. And if you look at everywhere there is a farming protest, it's because they've got that transition slightly wrong. They're slightly dumb policy. And I think that they will change that. I'm actually quite confident that if you look at the direction of travel, it is very strongly in favor of nature. On health, I may be slightly more pessimistic. I think there is a good chance that we will break the junk. If the junk food cycle is between our evolved appetite and the commercial incentives of companies, rather than tackling the latter, we may simply drug our way out of the problem with appetite suppressing drugs. And that was, I have recently been given some hope by a man called Eddie Abu, who was a weightlifter in the 80s. And Eddie's social media has gone from 500,000 at the beginning of the year to 3 million now. And literally, all he does is go around supermarkets with a camera filming the aisles of crap, filming the Mother's Day, 5, 10 meters of Mother's Day chocolate, saying, "Look at this. What do you want to do? Why do you want to eat this shit?" He says, "You want to kill your mother? You want to get your inheritance early?" And then he looks at the camera and he goes, "Wake the fuck up. Excuse me if your children are here." And I do believe that actually, that we are waking up to ultra-processed food and to what the food companies are doing to our appetites, and that therefore we might, if we're lucky, get some regulation that will stop that rather than simply drugging our way out of the problem. Thank you very much.